कफस उदास है यारों सबास है, कुछ तो कहो।
Welcome to the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast, also known as the SAS Pod. I am Lalita Duperron, Associate Director in the Center for South Asia. All our podcasts and information about the center are available at southasia.stanford.edu. Today, I am joined on the SAS Pod by Pashtana Durrani, who is the Executive Director and Founder of LEARN, an organization that works with women in Afghanistan to provide education, healthcare, and advocacy. Pashtana was a keynote speaker at a conference that we held at Stanford about a year ago on the stages of education in Afghanistan for women in particular. And I wanted to check in with her to see how things were going. We at the Center for South Asia are increasingly involved with various organizations that work on education in Afghanistan through some of our colleagues, Halima Kazem, Nasiruddin Nizami. And so I wanted to catch up with Pashtana and see what's been happening for her. Thank you so much for making time for me today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing this, of course.
Pashtana, can you start by kind of telling my audience who you are and what you do, as much or as little of your background as you're willing to share with us today?
Sure. Of course, let's do it. My name is Pashtana Durrani. I am a social and political rights activist. I am also an educator. I run this nonprofit called LEARN Afghanistan that focuses on girls' education from grade 7 to grade 12. We focus on ages from 13 to 18. We are right now active in more than 5 regions of Afghanistan. And the regions that we work with are the South and Central Highlands. We just expanded just before this started. I was talking to my team and we just posted about our school in Daikundi. So that's a good plus plus. But then apart from that, we have around, which is so exhilarating to say, I got the news yesterday that we have around 550 students, which is a huge benchmark for us right now. But then at the same time, the work that we do does not only focus on education. We are also involved in healthcare. We focus on emergency relief in natural disasters. We have been doing this for 5 years now, but since the overtake of the Taliban, my focus has mainly been women and young girls. I do also feel like LEARN's main mission is to cater to the ones whose rights are being abused the most, which is the young girls. So yeah, that's pretty much about me. But last but not the least, because I need to start crediting Wellesley more. I am an international scholar in residence at the Wellesley Women's Center. I just got done with my meeting, and I am a grad student at Harvard Graduate School of Education right now. Yeah.
And how did you get involved in this work? And you say a little bit about your personal background.
Sure. So I'm just going to be honest, very transparent here. I never intended to become this activist or person who runs NGOs or works with an NGO. I'm going to be honest, very much looked down on people who work within the NGO sector.
Okay.
The reason was because I think it was looked down back in the day, at least in from where I came from. It was either people, politicians who made changes, leaders, or also because Afghanistan is such a humanitarian industry, you know. Every nonprofit used their projects just to get more projects. Like nobody was working to change, or not to generalize it, but like that was the end goal, to get more funding.
So humanitarian industry. I have not heard that phrase. I understand what it means, and I love it. Thank you. That's so important for people to be aware of.
So I always thought like, oh, it's a humanitarian industry complex. People work for more projects. Education is a project for them. So I really didn't see myself as that person.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when growing up, my father established this school when we were in refugee camp. So I always saw us as educators, but not necessarily in this sort of this space, you know, the NGO sector or the private sector. So growing up, my father founded this school, which was for refugee girls. The only reason was because we were the last refugee camp village and nobody would sponsor us. And my father was like, you know what? We're going to open a school on our own. So I grew up with the notion like, oh, everybody get educated. Everybody has access to education. It's just a thing. Everybody opens school in their homes. And then your mother and aunts teaching that. And so that was the notion. But then at 16, when I moved back to Afghanistan, that's where I realized that not everybody has access to education. And given that my tribe and my people were IDPs, which is internally displaced people, they moved from the district that was actually taken by the Taliban as hostage. Given that most of their family was enlisted in the military and police, they had to move. So 400 families moved to Spinbuldak. And these families had good businesses, they had good, stable, safe spaces. The only thing missing was education and girls' schools. And I asked them, I was like, why don't we have schools? And they were like, oh, you know, everybody just thought, you know, everybody knows. And then when I went to the capital, the first thing I was told was like, your people don't want schools. So that sort of hurt me. But I think the post is still up on my Instagram. My cousin came to me and she was like, can you get ask the government to open the school? And this started this whole journey of opening schools or like, you know, working with rural tribal regions to ensure that this gap is filled or this notion is at least challenged that our people don't want education.
And this was after, this was before 2018, 2021.
Yes.
But back in Afghanistan, after you came back from the refugee camp.
Yes. So it's 2017 and 18 I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I am a teenager. I took a gap year and I was on this whole journey of like, you know, just doing an internship, ending up in a good college and everything. And then I saw around and I was like, you know what? No, I think maybe we should challenge some of these things. I think I'm also going to be honest. Now that I think of as a 26-year-old and reflect on it, I think my identity was also, I felt like it was attacked. Like every time I talked about rural tribal regions, even now when I talk about it, I get attacked so many times. And I sort of used to own it out of spite of people just to piss them off and in some ways. But now I think I own it. Just because our women are never able to own it, you know? So I wanted to own it, challenge that notion that no, rural tribal women want education. Who is this woman you're talking to and you
Right.
think she doesn't want education?
Right. So what I'm hearing is that some of the impetus to focus on education, I mean, it started in the refugee camp because of the work your parents were doing, and then going back into Afghanistan, you realize that rural tribal women were seen as not worthy, perhaps, of education or not desiring of education. And then the Taliban come back, and now you're kind of your motivation to help a particular group of people or to advocate for a particular group of people now becomes national. Is that pretty much how it went? All of a sudden you're like, oh, now there's a lot
I
of
mean,
people.
totally. If you read any of my interviews or talks with anyone before 2021, I'm strictly even the nonprofit was headquartered in the south, which was such an unusual thing because people would headquarter it in Kabul to meet donors and people. And I was like, no, we have to be headquartered in the south, you know, because this notion of, oh, the South is the stronghold of Taliban, you know. I just wanted to challenge that to the South is the stronghold for digital literacy and stuff like that. And then 2021 comes and the whole country becomes like, you know, the rural regions of South, you know. Everybody's give like, you know, limited from accessing education in one way or the other. And then women are banned and young girls are banned from accessing education altogether.
What was that like for you? Because you were dealing with some stereotypes and some prejudice. So, I mean, there's maybe a more educated women in the capital who may have some views on women in the South that are completely incorrect, and now all of a sudden they find themselves in the position that they thought rural tribal women were in. That must have been a complicated set of emotions for you.
Oh my God. I remember there's I mean, I have, I'm gonna be honest. When you are working in a space like this, and when it's a humanitarian complex, like it's a whole industry that thrives on making saviors out of normal people, it sort of is very competitive, and it sort of also is cutthroat. So people will come at you if they think you're threatening their livelihoods, you know. And I remember this group of women who were very famous, by the way, and I think I was recognized for something that I was doing, or like, you know, working on. And this is right at 2021 fall. And bunch of women just went on Twitter and started, like, you know, doing this whole hate online thing. The Taliban were doing them that on their own, but the women also started doing this. And this was this group of women who were actually supposed to be fighting for Afghan women and women rights. And that sort of, I mean, I sort of knew that this was going to happen at some point, but it sort of was also an eye-opening how much the generation before us had these stereotypes embedded in them, and they couldn't look beyond that. You know, it was so hard for them that they felt threatened of anyone who was going to challenge that. I kid you not, the million times I have told people, oh, education and digital literacy is going to work in rural areas, and people would just laugh at my face, and they would be like, what do you mean? Laptops, do you remember that policy of one child per laptop policy, or, like, you know, framework that failed immensely in Afghanistan? Do you even know internet is such a luxury? And I used to be like, okay, but for 20 years you have been using the money, you have been getting billions of dollars. What have you done with it? We are at war. What is the alternative to it? Like, we cannot wait for peace to happen, you know? It's not happening. So yeah, oh my God. I still remember. I still remember this one tweet where this lady was like, who, by the way, is extremely corrupt. Was like, oh, Persona should be thankful to the women in this network. They made it possible for her to be able to do this, you know, weave out fair and square. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, it took the whole parliament 20 years just to pass a law on child protection policy, which was never passed, by the way. The law was never passed. It was always challenged. This is the Republic of Afghanistan. And then the elimination of violence against women, it took years for it to be formulated, you know. So for me, yeah, I'm actually very disappointed with the older generation. And every time I go through something like this, men, women, everyone is just, like, you know, against you talking about it.
It's yeah, I mean, I guess that's something that happens in the NGO and activism space where people, it's the most disappointing where the people that you think you're on the same page are not on the same page. That's much harder than fighting the thing that you are supposed to be fighting to begin with. Absolutely. Tell us about Learn. And so yeah, tell us what the mission is and education, healthcare, advocacy, but tell us a little bit more what that actually looks like on the ground.
Sure. So I think, let me give you an example. So every day you walk into one of the Learn schools in Afghanistan right now, if it's in Kandahar, Dainkondi, Bamyan, or Helmand or Herat right now, which is such a diverse spaces and different ethnicities, different groups, different girls from different who have never met each other. All of them learn the same lesson. All of them learn the same space. In the same sort of space, they all have access to laptops, they all have access to internet, they all have access to teachers, and most importantly, they all are being supported by their communities. This is not me going to communities and telling them, oh, we have these dollars, thousands of dollars, and we want to educate your daughters. This is literally people reaching out to us and asking us to help them and support them in their girls' education. And this is happening in these regions. So proper biophysics, chemistry is being taught in these spaces. Mathematics, mental health and awareness is taking place. We're teaching them AI right now. We're teaching them journalism courses. You know, they are creating their own articles and everything. So it's that in the daily space when it comes to education. But then apart from that, we also have healthcare where women can walk into one of our clinics and they can access anything from, like, you know, prenatal to postnatal healthcare, menstrual hygiene management kits, you know, for their children, you know, everything. Literally, you can ask for an ultrasound, for a test. You can get the whole package, and that's all insured for you. And I was looking at our stats. The whole, like, our one of our clinic is catering to women even from the southeast and west regions, which is like six different provinces from different spaces. People literally come to that space just to access that free checkup. So it's all of that. But then at the same time, like, we were involved with like, relief, emergency relief last year with Herat. Like, I was just talking to my team about Baghlan. So we do all of that, and we have been heavily involved in all of that. I think when I was young, I wanted to be someone or have at least some power where if something like this would have ha happened, I could have done something about it without waiting for someone to help me do it, fund it for me. And now that I'm in that position, I take full like, I take full responsibility, but I also love the fact that I can do that. So it's like sort of, being in that space. But yeah, that's what Learn does right now.
So everything that we hear about Afghanistan is that none of this is allowed. So how are you, are we getting the wrong information, or tell us how this is happening?
Yes, all of the stuff that we do is not allowed right now.
Okay.
I
All
just
right.
want it to be completely transparent.
Anybody listening, don't tell anyone.
Yes. So yes, that is true. I mean, there are times where we have struggled with literally sending women sanitary pads in earthquake, where the Taliban wouldn't allow the team to, like, they would go through their stuff and they would be like, "No, you're not allowed to give this because you're a man. Why are you giving a woman a
Oh my
sanitary
God.
pad?" And we had to smuggle those into our Herat earthquake relief. We literally smuggled it in between blankets. We gave women blankets and we would smuggle it in blankets. Right now, we're finding innovative ways to do that with Baghlan. Schools are banned, but I also have women who literally show up to our spaces and they cry until if we don't give their daughters space. So it sort of is one of these places where the people want it, the communities want it, and this also gives me more, I think, strength, and I get a little overconfident when I offer these things, because every time somebody asks me, like, "How do you do it?" and I'm like, "Oh, I have people, and I really do. I really do. It's not possible without people. I can call someone in the middle of the night and tell them, "Oh, can you move this much packages for people in relief? Can you send these many girls these many books?" And this happens, because you have this good trust and goodwill among people, and they trust you, even if they have never met you. So that happens, and that's the possibility. But then at the same time, we had to change spaces in Kandahar more than seven times because we were under surveillance. So yeah, I'm not gonna deny that. Oh, it's all rainbows and it's possible. It's a lot of challenging. I personally struggle with a lot of my own PCOS stress symptoms that are high most of the time because of this. But it's also rewarding. It's rewarding to see that 550 girls get to go to school, 500 women get to access health care. People who might not have never ended up in emergency relief list because the Taliban take most of that funding will actually end up in that place. So it's rewarding. It helps you sleep. I don't know. It's maybe my, it's not even the savior complex in me talking. I just feel like it was my responsibility and I did my part,
I think helping people from your own community is very different from, quote
Yeah.
unquote, helping from a different place. And that's not to say that everything is bad, but it requires more introspection for sure for people from outside of the community. So, two things. Well, let's start with security. So, I mean, you're here. You're in Massachusetts. You're okay, but you have this immense network of people on the ground in Afghanistan who are, hardworking, and you can call, and they will move things as you as needed. It's unrealistic to think that the Taliban is not aware of that. So I want to ask you about their personal security, how that's safeguarded or not, as the case may be. And then you have a beautiful website, and your website, learnafghan.org, has curricula, it has syllabi, it is very open about what you do. So again, the Taliban knows what you're doing. Is there an argument that that they are condoning it because they actually, and I know there's not really a they there, right? It's not a government with one person. So it is this kind of somewhat unwieldy group of people who are probably not on the same page at all. But that a number of people are actually quite happy that this work is happening because women do need to be educated, actually. So let's talk, start with the security piece and then go to the condoning piece.
So with the security, we're highly mindful of where our schools are, how they are opened, who goes to those spaces, how it's framed. So for example, none of the schools have anything that shows that it's affiliated with LEARN. It more shows like it's a community effort, which is being run by the community. It is being funded by the community and people are volunteering time. It doesn't show as this extravagant luxury space where you can learn, or it's like, you know, being funded by bigger nonprofit or something, which we are not, by the way. Our schools are very like, you know, we have to be on tight budgets, but it does show that it's a community owned and led thing. And that's the reality of it. If we ever close our spaces, all the things will go back to the community, like the laptops, everything that we have. So that sort of gives us a very safety net in terms of who is in those spaces. But also, like, every time we go to a community, we don't introduce our own educators. We never introduce our own people in those places. When we go to a community, when they invite us, we do a needs assessment. And the first thing we ask them is like, what are you willing to commit? So it's a 75 to 25% rule that we always play. In the 25%, they have to give us a place. They have to introduce all their students. And they have to introduce all their teachers, and they are going to teach, and they have to volunteer that time. And then on our end, once we know it's safe, we will provide laptops, we'll provide internet, we'll provide teacher salaries, we'll provide maintenance fees. We're going to do everything. We're going to move mountains to make sure those girls get through grade 12 and stay in those learning space as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And that partnership works out beautifully. Sure, there are times where we have to close for 3 weeks because we feel like we're under surveillance. Sure, there are times where the numbers dropped, like, for example, the scarf ban that happened a few months ago. Our numbers in Bamiyan dropped drastically and we couldn't even understand what was happening, you know. And then we talked to the community and now the number, it's one of our highest, enrolled student school. So it's never all safe and we're always on top of it. Not really, I'm never gonna claim that, but it's also much more possible and feasible for us with the people that are in touch with them. So we don't ask the communities to meet us where we are. Like, you have to have all these things for us to work with you. We meet them where they are and then we try to build ourselves together. So that's a security aspect of it. And this goes to the website. The website is open and free. We give all our content to a radio site, which publishes it throughout Afghanistan in Pashto and Dari. We're partnered up with a SIM card company that publishes all our content on their site, free of, like, you know, internet cost and everything. And we do the same thing with communities. We give them all that access for free. And that's the end goal, is like to make education so accessible that it's not limited in brick and mortar schools, you know? So that's the security aspect of it. We're making it as accessible as possible. And if the website shut down, we'll come up with another website. It's not like, you know, the end of the world. If something happens, we'll move to another learning site. We have seen, sometimes I'm like, when I talk to my team, I'm like, we have seen the worst, which is the 2021. I don't think anything worse can happen than that. Think good might happen someday, hopefully, but this cannot get worse than what it already is. So we just have backups and we rely on those, yeah.
So what about the argument that the Taliban or certain people as part of the Taliban are secretly or maybe openly among themselves quite happy that people like you are doing this work because it means that they can maintain their platform of no education for women and yet also feel confident that there is actually a future of female doctors, female teachers, the people that are actually needed to keep the country going. And now you've become part of that mission. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, how does that feel?
I think about all the angles all the time. I think about the fact that when people think, when I talk about, oh, expanding to all 34 provinces, people think I'm saying let's replace public education with what we have right now, and I highly, highly am against it. I want all public schools open. I want them expanded to every single village, not only district, but village. And LEARN was established to fill that gap between the rural regions and the public schoolings, and how to make it beyond brick and mortar, make public education as possible, as accessible as possible. So that is the goal. Now, when it comes to the Taliban, if you look at it with this angle, and sure, in many ways, it could be a fair assessment, because so they would be like, oh, we don't care about it, blah, blah, blah. But then at the same time, as people who claim that they care about the country, as people who claim that they won the holy war, as people who think that they are the right people to rule Afghanistan, I think it's highly selfish of them to expect people who they deem traitors and spies to be doing their work for them, that, like, you know, which is called, I mean, for them, it would be dirty work. That would be the first argument. The second one would be, as people, we don't have an education policy framework. You go to a Ministry of Education website right now, we don't have any policy framework for Afghanistan. We don't know where we are going. We don't know where the boys are going who can still go to school. We don't know what our goals are. So we are cut off from not only from, you know, the world, but also the education framework in the whole worldwide. You know, I was doing research for my international finance for education, and Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Iran, and Pakistan, all of those countries have frameworks, have policies, and are going somewhere. And then Afghanistan's side doesn't even have a framework post 2021. And how sad is that? We don't know where our teacher capacity is. Even the UN doesn't know where they are going right now. Like, they're funding all these things, but they don't know where they're going. So I think at the end of the day, sure, maybe Taliban assume, oh, they're doing our work, we shouldn't care about it as much. But then as people who should be taking care of the country, or when they think that they were chosen to do that, you know, I think they're doing a very bad job at doing it. You know, they don't really have any goals, any ambitions, any frameworks, any policies that would put the country in the right pathway, you know, because you can fight and win the war, and then you can sell the whole country to China and Russia or Pakistan or whatever. But then at the end of the day, that country is the country that is supposed to progress, you know? So my argument again would be, if we were feeding into the system, they wouldn't be asking for my resignation, which they just did like a few months ago. And they wouldn't be tracing everything that we do so keenly, because they feel threatened. That's the one thing I feel like they personally feel threatened. And that's something that they really want to avoid. They just feel like if something like this happens, they don't want to spook more people. Like, they don't want to make a martyr out of it. So they just let it be and then shut it down whenever they can.
Right. Well, it sounds like when the shutdown comes, you have plenty of backup plans. You're well prepared. So that's good. What's the role of the United States or other countries' higher education system to support your work? That was part of the conference that we held. Can you speak to that a little bit? What is the global role, I guess, but particularly the United States? Because you're here, I'm here, so let's talk about the United States.
I think the higher education in the United States has single-handedly avoided the crisis that was made by the United States government. Let's keep it that way. I mean, it was such a disgraceful political move. And and it was single-handedly, by the way, saved by the United States education, a higher education system. And it's not even them doing it through government. I think it was more of the private entities, private parties, private schools, you know, who did that. The only reason I was able to do whatever I do is because somebody in Wellesley thought, oh, we should give it a place. And I came here and I got this place. And now because of that place, I can impact more than 550 girls every day and employ women and give access to healthcare and stuff. And I think the same thing is being done in many other higher education places, including Stanford. I think you already know about this. You would know better than me. But then those are the examples. And then comparing it to State Department's response, what they do when they go and tweet about it, it's just funny in many ways. And I see them doing the same blunders that the government of Afghanistan did in the past 2 decades. But I do think that the higher education not only provides places for people like me to feel safe, I would say, but also for people like us to thrive, for people like us to become part of a community that understands, yes, Afghanistan as a country is being failed by its rulers or leaders or whatsoever. But it still needs you, and we're going to give you that place, and we're going to support you in this, even if it's a failing cause, you know? And I think that is such a beautiful way. Like, it's humanity, because in the end of the day, the projects, the money is drying up for Afghanistan, you know? But higher education institutions are still standing up by Afghanistan. They still care about it. They still talk about it. They question a lot of the policies, and it's good to know that someone out there still has that critical thinking about it, you know?
I imagine that you're impacting a lot more than 550 women a day. I imagine your work has a very broad reach in all sorts of unexpected ways. And I would encourage any of our listeners who are inspired by what you do or want to learn more or are in a position where they can actually facilitate education for people from Afghanistan to get in touch with you, to learn more about you, to get in touch with us, whatever way, but what's the easiest way to contact you and learn more about your work, Pashtana?
So they can, when they want to learn about Learn, they can just head out to www.learnafghan.org, and you can find anything and everything, including our contact information, and you can follow our pages to stay up to date and everything of that sort. If they want to understand how I do what I do, they can head to my website, which is www.parsanadurani.com, and they can contact me directly and ask me questions or concerns or anything of that sort.
Okay, well, we'll link to these websites in the show notes. Thank you so much for making time. I know you're insanely busy, so it's been really great to have the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
As always, I want to thank Soham Shiva for creating the music of the Saspod and Manar Flevolkeniar for post-production. Thank you for listening to the SASPOD, the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast. Find out all about the Stanford Center for South Asia at southasia.stanford.edu and find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you can tune in again soon.